This week's episode of the Dive Podcast is brought to you by Neil Kelly, a leader in the design, installation, and maintenance of residential solar energy systems in Oregon. Visit neilkelly.com/solar to learn more and to schedule a complimentary solar assessment, or call them at 503-288-7461. Make a difference every day. Join Albertina Kerr as a caregiver, helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. You'll get great benefits, plus a $2,000 sign-on bonus. Apply for caregiver roles at albertinakerr.org/careers. Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show. It's Saturday, April 2nd, and this is episode 65 of The Dive. Today we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nigel Jacquess about Oregon House Speaker-turned-gubernatorial candidate Tina Kotek, and how even after 10 years in her position as Speaker, she doesn't seem to have the type of party support that we've grown accustomed to in a state that's been governed by Democrats for the past four decades. But Tina Kotek is kind of a hard case. She's pushed through the kind of progressive legislation that gives Oregon its hyper-liberal sheen, including the minimum wage increase, criminal justice reform, super aggressive housing legislation. But she's also part of what Nigel called our triumvirate of state leaders, outgoing Governor Kate Brown and Senate President Peter Courtney. So even though she's not an incumbent in the governor's office, when it comes to the disconnect between legislation and the logistics of implementation at a city level, she is kind of being treated like one. I've seen the disconnect between policy and reality in my own home. When my son was diagnosed with autism, I don't know, a year or so before the pandemic, we were assured up and down that the state support system was robust enough to meet many of the needs of an Oregon family navigating a disability diagnosis. Well, what we actually received was a different and unfamiliar social worker every time we reached out for support. Then the most these social workers could provide was the occasional email with a bulleted list of seasonal resources, most of which we had already found ourselves online. I also watched my elderly neighbors lose the home that they'd lived in for 30 years and become houseless as a result. The teachers at my son's school are spread so thin that average parents often receive requests to apply as paraeducators for a high-need special education classroom where therapists and educators all have advanced degrees. Nigel suggests his piece on Kotek as a straightforward political profile, but there is a greater discussion rooted in the simple sentiment that shit's not working. Nigel and I will unpack his profile of Kotek in one sec, but first, here are five things I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. Tenant advocates want a new capital gains tax, but Portland's corporate boardrooms have ruffled feathers over another proposed tax on high-income households. Well, that's the unmistakable message they sent via two recent ballot filings. Nigel Jacquess and Rachel Monahan report on how this election season is shaking out as a test of high-income Portlanders' willingness to subsidize their less fortunate neighbors. Mayor Wheeler wants to hire 200 new police officers, but after a chaotic couple of years and the high-profile firing of Union President Brian Hunsaker, journalist Tess Risky just has to ask, what would make someone want to become a police officer in Portland? 4,000 city vehicles, ranging from sedans to utility trucks, are repaired and stored in, literally, the most dangerously deteriorating property in the city's possession, and that's according to city budget documents. However, the budget office does not recommend funding repairs or relocation, citing the request has not been sufficiently vetted, reports Sophie Peel. Artist Cameron Mesmer gets it. This is just maybe not the funnest time to be a human. Their pop-up balloon art installation at Southwest 5th and Taylor exists solely to cheer us all up. So I guess I'll see everybody there this weekend, right? weather permitting, of course. And finally, Tina Kotek is a Marvel superfan who keeps a Captain America shield in her office. I see you, Tina. But Wakanda forever. Read these stories and more at WWeek.com. Now, back to the pod. Hello, Nigel. Thank you for joining me. Today we're talking about your cover story on Democratic frontrunner for governor, Tina Kotek, and how, despite her prolific record and tenure as Speaker of the Oregon House, none of her Democratic contemporaries are endorsing her? Why is that?
Well, I think there are a variety of different reasons. There are five current and former Democratic governors. None of them has endorsed her. So also Peter Courtney, who's the longest serving Senate president in history, really in this state, particularly over the past 2 years, the House Speaker, which was Tina Kotek, the Senate President Peter Courtney, and the Governor Kate Brown, really ran the state, the three of them. And so Courtney and Kotek overlapped for 10 years. They led the legislature for 10 years, and Courtney is also not endorsing Kotek. So different reasons. But it is striking that the people who have held the job Kotek wants and the person who has worked most closely with her, none of them is endorsing her in this primary.
That stood out to me right off the bat. And not just that so many people were not willing to endorse her, but how they actually were kind of coming for her. They're kind of coming after her conduct. The state rep, Margaret Doherty from Tigard, yep, straight up suggested that Tina Kotek has no integrity.
So, you know, Kotek is an interesting and different kind of leader for many leaders that we see in Oregon. She is very direct. She is very blunt. She's steely. She just goes forward. That's a good thing in many ways, but it also means that sometimes you have to knock people out of the way. Sometimes you make hard bargains, and people may disagree on whether she's kept the bargains. I cited two instances in the story that a lot of people are troubled by. One is that State Representative Janelle Bynum, who is Black and is an emerging leader in the legislature, went to Kotek in 2020 and said, hey, it's time for a person of color to be Speaker. And I'm thinking about running against you. And Kotek said, well, if you would hold off, I will support you in the future. And what support means is now a matter of disagreement. Bynum has told me that she took that to mean Kotek would throw her considerable weight behind Bynum in the next leadership election. Kotek said that's not the case. She merely meant she would be supportive, didn't commit to anything. So they disagree on what was the outcome of that meeting. That's caused a lot of hard feelings in what's called the BIPOC caucus, the People of Color caucus in the House, many of whom felt that Kotek went back on her word. Bynum feels that Kotek went back on her word. Kotek says it was a misunderstanding. So that's one. The second is that in 2021, the Republicans were blocking the Democrats' agenda in the regular session of the legislature by enforcing a little-used rule that allows them to have every single bill, and a bill could be 100 pages long, read in its entirety before it could be considered. That's highly unusual. It slows things down to a crawl. You could never get business done that way, and that was the Republicans' intent, because the Democrats have a supermajority, which means they can essentially do whatever they want. So Kotek said, look, we're not going to get our agenda done unless the Republicans stop doing that. What would it take for them to stop doing that? So at the same time, the legislature was engaged in this once-a-decade, highly political process of redrawing legislative and congressional districts. With their supermajority, they're in a position to dictate what those districts would look like. So Kotek offered House Minority Leader Christine Drazen a very big carrot. She said, look, if you guys will stop slowing down our agenda, we will give you equal representation on this committee, which they didn't have to do. Democrats could have just said, we're in the majority, we're going to have a majority on the committee. Drazen said, okay. The legislation proceeded, the Democrats enacted their agenda, the session went smoothly. Then in September, when it was time to draw the lines, Kotek says that Drazen and her team, the House Democrats, never put forth a proposal for legislative maps. So in other words, they got equal representation on the committee, but the Democrats say they didn't follow through and didn't negotiate in good faith. So she said to Drazen, look, I gave you equal participation, but now I'm taking that back, and Democrats are going to have a majority specifically on the committee that draws congressional lines. So the Republicans accused Kotek of lying, of going back on her word, and I think even some moderate Democrats like Margaret Doherty were very troubled by the appearance of that. Again, Kotek says she didn't lie, that the Republicans simply failed to fulfill their side of the bargain. So, you know, truth is in the eye of the beholder in many cases, particularly in politics. But I think regardless of whom you believe, you know, Kotek drives a hard bargain, and she is a very, very skilled operator. She cuts a lot of deals, and sometimes those deals leave people with hard feelings.
Yeah, she's tough, very tough.
Yeah.
How did you build this story out? As I know that a lot of it came from interviews, but how much of this information did you source from public record?
I would say in this case, you know, I read a lot of the bills and I read a lot of the bill testimony, but for the most part, this was a story. This is more, a lot of the stories I do are investigative stories. This is much more of a sort of a traditional political profile of a, you know, of a person who is, has been in the public eye for a long time, but isn't very well known. As she says, she's an introvert, she's a private person. So a lot of what I did was review her legislative record. I reviewed, you know, some public records, but mostly talking to people who were serving alongside her in the Democratic House caucus, serving across the aisle from her in the Republican House caucus, talking to lobbyists, talking to some legislative staff, trying to really surround her, you know, a 360-degree view of her, what she like, how does she work. So the concern about Kotek specifically and Democrats generally in Salem is that they are too beholden to public employees because those public employee unions fund Democratic campaigns. So in 2019, Kotek had these very strong competing demands upon her. Since 1990, Democrats have been looking for a new source of funding for schools, for K-12 education, because in 1990, voters passed property tax limits that really changed and limited the way that schools were funded. So ever since then, for more than 30 years, the Democrats have been looking for a new source of money. They had finally gotten to the point where they were right on the brink of passing a bill in 2019 called the Student Success Act. It would provide $1 billion a year and more for K-12 education. So it was the holy grail of Democratic politics. However, in order to pass that bill, there were certain business interests and their supporters in the legislature who said, we will not pass that bill. We will not support that bill unless we see some material and meaningful cuts to the public employee retirement system. Kotek, in order to get what everybody wanted for education, which was this new tax, she had to say to the public employees, hey, I'm going to cut your pension benefits. So she had to tell the people who brought her to the building something they really didn't want to hear and they really didn't like. And so I really focused the story a little bit on that conflict, because here is the person in Kotek that people say is too beholden to public employee unions, making a hard decision to cut those public employee unions. And she was willing to do that. It was very hard for her members. Some of them still hold it against her. Many of the union's members hold it against her. But she got the votes to pass the Student Success Act and therefore, you know, the most meaningful tax increase in 30 years and perhaps in state history. So I think it illustrates the high stakes with which she plays and her ability to do hard things.
What was left out of the story?
I think that if I had more time and more space, I would really want to delve more deeply into kind of the last section of the story. Okay, the Democrats under Tina Kotek and really with her leadership have passed a lot of ambitious legislation, the tax increases we've talked about, they've passed family leave, a big minimum wage increase, a lot of housing legislation that is both tenant-friendly and designed to increase the housing supply in the state. They've put a lot of money into that as well. They put a lot of money into mental health services, and yet the state has test scores for students. They're terrible. If you look at mental health outcomes, they're awful. Yeah. If you look at the substance abuse services we provide, they're the worst in the nation, or almost the worst in the nation. So I would really like to write more and investigate more the question of all this ambitious legislation, all this new funding, why aren't things better? What's the causal relationship there? If public employees have so much influence, how does that translate into outcome? So I think that's really the big question in this governor's race and in Oregon generally, is in a state that has so many natural resources and a pretty progressive government, why are outcomes so bad? You know, we have outcomes in a number of key areas that make us look like a state in the Deep South, like a Mississippi or an Alabama or a Louisiana. And there's nothing wrong with those states per se, but they spend a whole lot less money on education, on health care, on mental health, on housing, on transportation. They don't do any of the things that we do. They don't spend nearly as much money as we do in those areas, and yet our outcomes are comparable with them. And that's perplexing.
It is. I am fascinated also, what is the disconnect? Because for a long time, I did not see it in my day-to-day life, but now I see it whole cloth in my everyday life. My neighbors have lost their house, you know, left and right. And then my son is autistic, so we rely on county mental health services, which are also very, very scant. Meanwhile, there's supposedly all this money being funneled into these services, but me, as a constituent, I don't really see it.
Well, I think one of the key quotes in the story that I tried to frame the story around is a quote from Jules Bailey, who actually served in leadership with Kotek in the House. And you know, he's a Democrat. He's a progressive. He's a Portland guy. He's a guy who would support pretty much any tax measure. And he said, you know, we're a high tax state with poor services. And he said, shit's not working. And he was at the table for many of these bills, and I think that is the mystery of Oregon. And so if you ask me what was left out, I think the story could, you know, we'll do a lot more with that question as the governor's race unfolds. But I do think that's the question that really fuels this race and fuels the political debate and discourse in Oregon is, why aren't things better?
Do you think that Tina will win?
You know, I'm not a betting man. I think that she has to be considered the favorite both in the primary and in the general, just because, you know, Democrats outnumbered Republicans by about 10 percentage points. And many of the people who are not affiliated voters, affiliated with neither party, skew Democratic. And the Democrats have won every governor's race since 1982. So you would say, probably. However, big caveat, Betsy Johnson is a really formidable candidate. She's the non-affiliated former Democrat who served in the legislature for 20 years, but is that person who straddles both parties. And she's going to have a tremendous amount of money to spend. Secondly, voter sentiment is at a 30-year low, meaning that people are more unhappy today than they have been in 30 years. That usually doesn't augur well for the status quo or for anybody who looks like an incumbent. And Kotek has been part of the triumvirate that's run this state for the past decade. So she is, while not an incumbent, she is the closest to an incumbent in this race. So there is a scenario in which she and Betsy Johnson, the unaffiliated voter, split 60 or so percent of the vote, and a Republican, a generic Republican, wins with 40%. So Kotek is the most likely to win, Johnson could win, and a Republican could easily win. So I'm usually not this wishy-washy, but it won't shock me. None of those three outcomes would shock me.
Quite a read. I didn't really know that much about Tina, just kind of superficial stuff. So it's really interesting. I gotta say, like, reading this felt like a little bit like reading a burn book, you know? Like, a lot of these disagreements seemed kind of petty, and there was a lot of miscommunication happening, and it just seemed like, wow, drama, unnecessary drama.
Well, remember that everybody in politics is the star of their own movie, and everybody, and that the legislature is like high school with much higher stakes.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. That was the feeling I got. This is like high school, but with much higher stakes. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. Scary.
Totally scary. Yes. And on that note, Nigel, thank you so much. Okay. Have a great day.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks, Brianna. Bye-bye.
Thank you to my guest this week, Nigel Jaquess, and our sponsors, Neil Kelly. And a thank you to you for tuning in. I really hope you'll tune in next week. Until then, bye!